Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
How's it going? Welcome to Someone Who Isn't Me, episode number 18. This one is with Dan Searle, drummer of the band Architects. And this episode's a bit different from some of the others for a couple of reasons, but the most important one being is the fact that Dan actually got in contact with me asking if he could come on the podcast, and that was because he wanted to speak about his twin brother Tom, the guitarist and songwriter in Architects, who passed away because of cancer in August 2016. So we sat in his flat and we spoke for almost 2 hours about Tom, about how Dan's been in the 6 months since his brother's passing, and we spoke about Architects and we spoke about what the future holds for them. Normally when I record an episode of Swim, I prepare notes which take on some sort of semblance of questions, and I just try and have a conversation with the guest, but I actually left those in my bag for this one because I thought that this was very much a conversation that Dan should lead. And it was a tough one to do, and anyone that knows Dan or myself will appreciate that in amongst some very dark and heavy discussion, there was like a lot of laughs and there's funny moments as well. There's also one part where it almost feels like, where it feels like we're skirting around a particular subject, which I suppose in hindsight was essentially what happens to consciousness, if you will, after leaving sort of material existence. And I didn't want to press him with it, to be honest. So it was actually a conversation we had once we'd stopped recording. So aside from that, it was a very honest and candid conversation that I know is going to get transcribed and pulled apart for various news pieces. And that's kind of the point on why Dan wanted to do it. He said he didn't want to have to sit and have those kind of conversations in interviews with people that he doesn't really know. So feel free to pick this one apart. If you write for any news outlets, however, please don't put shit out of context for clickbait, as that is weak. And if you can make sure that you link back to the podcast on iTunes, people can search for Someone Who Isn't Me, also on acast.com/someonewhoisntme. That way people can listen to the whole thing if they're interested. Architects have just started their North American tour. They're going to be playing at Reading and Leeds Festival in the UK this summer, as well as a bunch of others like throughout Europe and whatnot during festival season. All dates can be found online on their Facebook page, which is facebook.com/architectsuk. Their album All Our Gods Have Abandoned Us, the album that gets discussed in this episode, is not only crushing, but it's an incredible piece of work. So if you're not aware of that album already, you should go and check it out. This is Dan Searle.
So it's interesting that you emailed me for a start, because if I'm honest, I would never have said to you, come and do an episode of the podcast, sure, or come and do something on the radio.
Yeah,
I mean, I understand why. In my head, I've reasoned why. Mm-hmm. But tell me a bit about that.
Well,
first.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to make a point of that, because I'm not Corey Taylor or Maynard James Keenan or Chino Marino or even Sam Carter, for that matter. And the fact that you've had Sam on the podcast already makes it look even odder that I am a guest on your show. So I wanted to make the point that I asked to be on here, because I don't want, and I have a tendency to overthink things, I don't want people to think that you asked me looking for some kind of story.
Yeah.
I didn't want people to think, oh, well, Dan's obviously Okay, I'm going to have to say Dan Carter when I'm speaking in this term. Dan Carter has asked Dan Searle to be on a show because there's a big juicy story there with some minor headlines that might interest people. The fact of the matter is, it's been 6 months, just over 6 months since Tom died now. And I've had people ask me to speak to them, magazines specifically. And I didn't want to, I didn't feel like that was the right medium for me to sort of go about speaking about this for the first time. You know, the people at the magazines are well-intentioned. I don't think they're just doing it to get a juicy story. I think they want to support us after we've been through a difficult thing.
Yeah.
So there's no slight on them. It's just that I wanted to speak freely about this subject. I didn't want it to be edited. If it's in print media, I don't know what's going to be included and what's not out of a conversation.
And even when something is written down, it can be taken
out of context.
You can read things certain. Sure. Even if it's not out of context, you can still read things in a different manner. So I understand.
So that was really important to me, yeah. And you knew Tom. You had some awareness of what he was going through.
Yeah.
And I felt that I know you well enough to know that I can speak to you about things that in a way that you will appreciate and understand, whereas I don't know if that will be the case if I speak to someone at a magazine or not, you know.
Yeah.
So this just felt like the right way to do it. I also felt like, oh, this is dropping dropping like a big sort of a heavy thing on your shoulders, in a sense, because it's, you know, it's not an easy conversation. It's not, I'm not promoting an album here, you know. Yeah. I know that's not what everyone speaks to you for, but this sort of felt like a bit of a selfish thing for me. Like, it might be cathartic in some way for me to publicly speak about certain things, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I really appreciate that you thought of me, because I think it is all those things, and I do. It's the only one of these that I've done so far where I actually had to think about it, in the sense that was it something like I didn't want, and I would never have turned around and said no, let's not do that, obviously, because we're friends, and obviously I understand the reason you're doing it, but at the same time, it is, there's a lot to it. And I did think that a lot of people would be like, well, this guy's a dick, why the hell is he asking him about this sort of stuff, and then I was like, well, whatever, it doesn't really matter, because once, I think, you know, once people get to hear it, then they'll realise that I've not phoned you up in a, I don't know, I want to say not ghoulish, but because that sounds, I don't mean it to sound like that, but do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, and I had thought about it, and I had definitely you know, I had wanted to make sure that people didn't read into it the wrong way.
Yeah,
because it might seem random. Oh, Dan Searle's on Dan's show, why would he?
No, I don't think that anyone would view it from that way, because there's obviously a lot to talk about, and there's and people do want to know, and I don't think that's because they're using that word again. It's the wrong word to use, because I don't mean it to sound disrespectful, but people obviously want to know.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't know the full, I want to say, story, I suppose. And even when Tom was alive, it was a small group of people who really knew what was going on. And it very rarely extended beyond the band and family, really. But obviously, you know, Tom spoke to you
when we did Maid of Ale,
the Maid of Ale session, and I spoke to you at the Crying Awards,
yeah,
to let you know that that it had come back, and that Tom was going to have surgery the following day. And you were at the wake.
Yeah.
And when I spoke at the wake, I wanted to make sure that people got a sense of how Tom was.
Yeah. I thought that was incredible. Your eulogy at the wake was amazing. It really was, because to have to do those terrible things for a family member is a tough thing to do. Mm-hmm. To have to do it for your twin brother is, I can't even imagine. But then to do it in the manner that you did, where it just came across like it was like the darkest stand up I've ever witnessed. Yeah. And it was fantastic, which sounds like a terrible thing to say. I don't, but it really was.
Yeah.
On every level. And
yeah,
and I thought you got across a lot of really beautiful things, but did it in such a way that just when it felt like everybody was going to implode with grief.
You know, I felt like everyone was coming up to me after I spoke and saying how funny it was. It was easy to be funny because the tension of the occasion was so high. There's so much emotion at a moment like that. So that when you break the ice with something a little bit outrageous or something silly or whatever it is, people are just, they laugh extra because it's almost like a relief, you know, that everyone is allowed to laugh, you know, that this doesn't have to be the sort of bleak occasion that it could be. I wanted to, and you know what, I wanted that's a reflection of Tom.
Yeah, 100%.
And some of the stuff that people found hilarious was just me repeating stuff Tom had said, you know. And that, you know, and I want to touch on that a bit, because obviously Tom has some public status, and people, you know, cared about him, people that Tom didn't know. And of course you hear a story about someone who's 28 dying of cancer, and it's a very sad story, and it resonated with people. And I think it's important for people to know, and this is what I wanted to make clear at the wake to some degree, was that it wasn't all totally bleak. That Tom was good-humoured.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I've touched a little bit with what I've said online, but me and Tom had, like, some great times when he was sick.
Well, from my perspective, when I had that conversation with him at Maida Vale, he was, again, really funny. And he was saying things that I was laughing at because, A, they were funny, but also I was laughing because his approach to it and his attitude and the way he seemed to be dealing with everything was amazing. And it was blowing my mind that people can view things in that way.
With that kind of adversity.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. I think I repeated some of these things when at the wake. When he first got to the hospice, he told them, me and him were both joking with the nurses, and Tom was saying that his wishes were to be slaughtered halal style. And be hung upside down and have his throat slit, and then he said he wanted to be fed to pigs at his funeral. And at one point he was getting taken care of by the nurses. This is probably 10 days before he died. And he asked the nurses to pass for his phone, because he said he needed a new Tinder profile picture. Yeah, he was never on Tinder, but he's just that's, you know, he was still just fucking around and joking around, even in a very, very difficult situation.
Yeah, but then it's an amazing coping mechanism, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, but what you just touched on a moment ago about when when we saw you at A Maid of Ale. And, you know, Tom was saying, you know, he was sort of telling you about where it was in his body at that point and saying, you know, but I'll be okay.
Yeah.
A lot of people read the lyrics, you know, to Gone with the Wind, Memento Mori, and think, you know,
that he'd given up.
He'd given up.
Yeah, no, I didn't get that at all, which is why I was, it was such a shock.
Yeah.
Because that conversation, I mean, I know that you did the session and you were planning to go out and do the Bring Me tour in Australia, right? And you were trying, you were like, the only way we can do it is if it actually lined up with something that you guys were doing.
Yeah.
And it turned out that that was actually, that event was happening in Australia. So it felt like there was a real optimistic...
It was... And this is the thing, this is what no one really understands that didn't know him, is that there was so much talk of the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, I look back at those lyrics now and think, now I read them, I go, what, had Tom given up? You know, because, but the thing is, with any lyrics, it's a snapshot, you know.
Yeah.
It's a snapshot of a moment, and Tom wrote some of those lyrics right after his cancer came back, which is around May 2015, and it hit him, you know, but he was also like so we went to South America, we did Slam Dunk, he had found a lump in his leg,
yeah,
and then he had to have tests, and we were going to South America. We couldn't afford to cancel, so he stayed at home and we did it as a four piece. And then he called me when we were in Buenos Aires and he said, oh, it's cancer, it's come back. So I go on a plane, come straight back home, and to try and get to his appointment with the doctors, you know, so I could be there.
Yeah.
And I was like obviously upset and worried. But when I got back to the UK and I got to, I got back to my flat, and then I went up to my mum's and Tom was there, and we went up to the doctors and Tom was fine.
Yeah.
Like, joking around. It's been... And straight away I was like, oh, well, that relieved me to a degree. But I had spent, you know, it's a long journey home from Buenos Aires on your own.
And you'd just been playing it through in your mind.
Yeah, and then I got home and Tom was just like pissing around.
Yeah.
So I was like, right, okay, I understand. And yeah, he missed some shows. But during that period, that summer, yeah, he had some moments where he was worried, understandably.
Of course.
And he wrote lyrics about it.
Hmm.
And we wrote the album that summer, most of it. Just me and Tom, like, in his bedroom, just write, you know, and it was the best creative experience that we ever had.
Yeah, it's that was the thing, like when the record first came out and when I'd first got it, and I was, you know, kind of going through it all, and it's so intense, and it does feel at moments that it is really bleak.
Yeah.
But I always found that there was it was tempered with a positive energy.
Yeah.
That's how I felt anyway.
And that everyone gravitated towards this word, bleak, when it came to describing it.
Well, of course, yeah.
And it's a funny thing, because when me and Tom were working on those songs, especially it was around July and August 2015, it was like Tom was very happy.
Yeah.
Honestly, probably the happiest he had ever been.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? In the sense that I think you can make great art that can be the where you can pour everything into it and actually feel. It sounds a little hippie, but quite cleansed by it. But it is a cathartic thing.
Get as hippie as you want with me.
Yeah, man. Great, awesome. Because. Maybe that was the way that all of that negativity was being taken out.
You know? Well, and that thought has crossed my mind for sure. For me, it was easier than for Tom, of course. And at that point, things were very hopeful.
Yeah. How was it for you though, like working on those songs, especially like seeing the lyrics and stuff? But it must have been quite jarring to see that he was the most creative and happiest he's ever been. Yeah,
but with his dark lyrics.
Yeah.
Sure, and it was only really those two songs that really hit me. The other songs are more a bleak world view.
Yeah.
But it was Memento Mori and Gone with the Wind that, you know, I heard Gone with the Wind in September, and I was in Barcelona. We had finished writing it, but him and Sam had worked on the vocals, and they had sent me the chorus, and it's, you know, the lyrics are sickness with no remedy except the one inside of me. But that was just reflective of Tom's philosophy on the disease, because he felt like, you know, medicine struggles with cancer, and he felt like, well, the answer is inside of me, because people do get better.
Yeah.
And me, I became very, all I read about was cancer.
Yeah.
For about a year and a half.
And were you, I'm assuming that he was as well, but were you?
No.
He wasn't?
No.
Well, that's interesting. So were you the guy that was finding everything, and then going, have you thought about this? Have you thought about this?
Yeah. Exactly. So, to protect him, I suppose, you know.
Of course.
I'm going off on tangents all over the place, but
no, that's fine.
That was, I spent a lot of my time, all my time, writing, reading, thinking about, talking about cancer, unless I was with him, and then I would just tell Tom, you know, I've heard this helps. But I became very interested in this concept of, you know, spontaneous remission.
Yeah.
And SIBO effect, all these kind of things.
Well, that's the thing, because when he was telling me in Maida Vale about the Joe Dispenza thing, and anyone that doesn't know his work, The Placebo Is You is the best place to start, like, I guess, with his book, where he's saying...
Yeah, you are the placebo.
Are you the placebo. Yeah. My apologies. And then, because on first glance, a lot of people would be very dismissive about it. But it is actually hard science that he's worked into. And I think that the idea that a person, I mean, is, you know, the physical matter of a person, shall we say, because there is that's not a whole of a person, in my opinion. Anyway, you are a bag of chemicals,
sure.
and you are manufacturing chemicals constantly, some of which have truly miserable adverse effects, and some of which can counteract those and have very positive effects. And I know that was something that you were both really looking into.
Yeah, we went away to like one of his meditation retreats in Italy in, I want to say, April. And the doctor told Tom not to go because they thought it was a bad idea in case things got worse, but he went anyway, and it really helped him. And we had an incredible weekend together.
Helped in what way? With his mindset, with his physicality,
with his mindset. I mean, me and Tom was meditating 2-4 hours a day, and I would often meditate 2 hours with him.
Together?
Yeah.
And how was that as an experience?
Profound and important in just helping us get through it. But all those lessons we learned in terms of the importance of your mind, I think it was invaluable for both of us.
Yeah, I think so, because I think, I was going to say it gives you a grounding, but it's not. It's almost the total opposite of that.
It's a reminder that, you know, we are not our bodies. And we are just a bag of chemicals and, you
meat
know,
and water.
We identify with our thoughts and our behaviors and our beliefs, but they're just conditioned responses, conditioned neurological pathways in our brains that we call Daniel P. Carter and let's say Daniel J. Searle, because it's the middle name. And it we had like really joyful moments together from that.
Yeah.
And, you know, like that's, I learned a lot then that's helped me now as well. You know, like I still meditate every day. Only the last couple of months I've been able to again. But it's...
Why couldn't you in that period? Surely that would be the time when it would be the most beneficial.
You would, absolutely, you would think so.
Was it just too much of a reminder of what it when you first started doing it?
It opened up like you have to just bear with me because I'm it's actually a bit harder than I thought it would be.
Okay, no, that's fine, man. I didn't ever think it wasn't going to be anything other than that. That's why I was wary.
Yeah.
If you want to take a minute.
No, it's fine.
Or should I pause it?
No, it's okay. It's fine. When Tom first died, I think when you lose anyone like that in your life, you kind of just go into shutdown a bit. Yeah. And I felt bad, you know, and emotional. But usually I just smoked weed or drank alcohol.
Yeah.
And I was not abusive. I'm not a destructive guy. I would hit a vaporizer a couple of times. I'm very practical. You know, I don't like go off the rails. I'm just not who I am.
Mm.
And so I kind of just swept everything under the rug to a degree.
And when it got to a point, you would dial it down.
Yeah.
With those.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's a very understandable thing to do.
For whatever reason, meditation just opened up the well of grief.
Yeah. But do you think that that's very specifically doing that for a reason?
Absolutely. And it's about the end of December last year, so just a couple months ago, I just hit a wall with it and started getting anxious, and it was just, you know, a wake up call, like I can't just hide it.
Yeah. I think the way that you've all dealt with this has been very, it's been as open as anyone would expect.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's going, when's this next Facebook post going to happen that tells me everything that I want to, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think that's such a beautiful thing to have witnessed, that everyone around the band, be it other bands, your friends, and the music community at large and fans, has been so incredible, it seems.
And that's only really hitting me in the last couple of months. Because, yeah, I stopped drinking, stopped smoking, weed, not cigarettes. I don't smoke cigarettes at all, for the record. Yeah. I'm still smoking loads of cigarettes, but no, I don't smoke cigarettes at all. And I just kind of realised I just had to deal with it.
Yeah.
And it's, in our culture, you know, grief or no grief, people don't like to just be, you know, we take our phones to the toilets.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, being alone with your thoughts can be a really tough time for...
People are terrified of it.
Yeah.
You know, at the best of times. Yeah. You know, it's like they don't want to be alone, and if they are alone, they've got to be watching TV or looking at Instagram or Twitter or whatever. Mm. And failing those, and there's always alcohol or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever your vice is. So it just got to the point where I thought, well, you know, I've got to, I've just got to deal with it head on. And
Was there a discussion with anyone about it, or did you just
my girlfriend?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was her, what did she, did she agree?
Yeah, she always knows what's best for me. And
they
I
always
don't,
do.
And I don't realise it at the time.
Yeah.
Usually, and usually I get mad at her if she tells me something I don't like. But then, like, a month, 2, 3, 4 months later, I go, yeah, remember when you said that to me? Mm. Yeah, you were right, actually. And that's happened over and over again.
Yeah.
So I apologise to her. But yeah, so it's not been easy for her to be in this situation.
But then you should never beat yourself up over that.
No, of course, no, and I don't, and she asked me not to, you know. But, you know, she always keeps an eye on me at the best of times, but after Tom died, she said, do what you need to do. Which was sort of the green light for me to be like, you know, I like smoking weed.
Yeah.
And I was actually talking about this. I can't remember who with. But a few days after Tom died, we went to his flat because Adam, our guitarist, lived there part-time. He lives in Vancouver normally, but when he's over, he lived at Tom's because he had a spare room. And we all went over there because we knew we were going to have to move the stuff out soon, and we were just sort of, you know, well, let's go to Tom's and be together and whatever. And I had a bottle of red wine and some good weed and a vaporizer and just, you know, got stuck in. And it made me go from, like, despondent to jovial to fine, good, you know. Yeah. It didn't just numb me. I had a great time, you know.
Yeah.
And our sound guy, Johnny, was in Brighton doing some work for us, prepping some stuff for the future or whatever, and he came over. And I was looking back yesterday, I think, thinking, what must he have thought of me? Because I was just, like, joking and pissing around.
But then, as I said, no one's going to ever judge anyone for dealing with their own sure. life in that way.
Sure, I just think it must have been a jarring thing to witness against what he had perhaps expected, you know.
Yeah, I did a very similar thing when a friend of mine passed away, and he was actually the guy that managed our band, and we all went over to his flat and went through it, and it was exactly that. And afterwards, we all kind of looked at each other and were like, I'm glad it was just us here.
Mm. Yeah.
But then I also think, well, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's how it should be.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't think anyone that moves on wants to at any point look back and go, look at those maudlin people about how they're acting.
Yeah,
but then
yeah.
that's a whole other conversation about the wider scheme of things and what happens and what, you know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I don't think you should ever beat yourself up over the fact that I don't.
It's just I've sort of the whole way through the last 6 months tried to sort of figure out grief, you know, and it's such a strange, you know, there's, because of the complexities of personalities and every person being so infinitely different in so many intricate ways,
yeah,
finding a way that is appropriate, the best way to deal with it is there's no one really knows,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
How do you mitigate the pain of grief effectively? And I'm the kind of person that just wants to intellectualize everything and then fast track it. Just let me fast track it. You're like, I want to do everything. I want to hack everything the best way I can. Mm. You know, that's all. So, you know, I started playing guitar. I want to learn guitar as quickly as I possibly can. Well, news just in, Dan. You can't. I'm not going to be Vi overnight. And,
yeah.
You know, dealing with anxiety. Well, what's the best? How do I deal with this quickly and get it over and done with? Grief. How do I get, you know, will I get over Tom dying? If I just think about the worst memories over and over again and get it all out and cry as much as I can and well, no, that doesn't work either, because I tried that, and it just makes you feel really, really awful.
What, you thought that was actually going to be the way
track? Someone told me, some family friends told me, a friend of mine, his mother died when I was a teenager, and he's a close friend of my mum's. And I saw them a few days after Tom died, and they were just sort of, in a sort of quite cynical English way, saying, oh, you got to cry for 100 hours, And of course I didn't take that literally. But I think some part of me thought, right, okay, there's a certain amount in me.
Go.
Can I just squeeze it all out as quickly as possible and get it over and done with? Because this is exhausting and tiring, and I just want to, if I can just sprint the rest of the marathon instead of walking it, then great, and then I can relax the rest of the day, sort of thing, But that is the way I tend to be with everything, I go exercise until I get injured, and then I have to stop. It's part of my personality that I recognise that I need to learn to pace myself.
But then at least you did do that with the meditation, but maybe then that's... I think that is... Yeah, I see why that would have been so hard. But I also see that it would be truly beneficial.
Well, the last 2 months, meditation has just been so important, so invaluable to me.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like riding a bike, And I did an intensive course, essentially, when Tom was ill.
Was that the first time that you'd approached it doing it?
No,
as well?
I'd meditated in the past, but it was the first time where I'd meditated where I would do like an hour meditation.
Yeah.
And
also, if you're doing led meditations and also joint meditations and group meditations, then that is a different thing, isn't it? From just trying to sit in a room and switch your thoughts off for 10 minutes.
Yeah, there's so many different types of practice and we explored a number of different types, actually. But now I just... It's so useful for me to just sit down. I don't do hour meditations now, but I will do one or two 25-minute meditations every day. And, it's without sounding like I'm saying it in a really, escapist, negative way, it's like, one of my... The nicest bits of my day. And I think to most people that sounds... quite, I don't know, sad or...
I don't think so. Scared.
Yeah, you're not a normal person. I don't know. If people think, oh, God, the best part of your day is just sat down doing nothing, well, that sounds like you've got a pretty boring life or whatever.
That sounds fantastic on any level, I think.
But it's just about being with yourself and, feeling how you feel and accepting it, and obviously coming back to your breath and just bringing about awareness. And that awareness is just so important in so many other areas of your life. And, we were texting before we started about you getting some filthy vegan food. And I said, I won't judge you.
Did. and some of it is still sat here.
But, I'm absolutely not... I'm no angel, but... I do try to my best to remember not to judge, and I do these simple things like that throughout my day. I be aware of the way I'm behaving and not beat myself up if I behave badly, but understand that I've conditioned myself over 29 years to behave that way, but bring awareness to it and change it if you don't like it, and accept that you don't have to be who you think you are. And I kind of always grew up thinking, well, this is who I am. And they're always part of that. Everyone has bits about their personality they don't like, and we're never going to be perfect, and no one's aiming for perfection here. But recognizing that we're always in flux and evolving, and we can always, if we bring awareness to them, change the things about ourselves that we don't necessarily like, or the things that don't necessarily serve us, which is probably better put.
Do you think they'll... And I really don't want you to think that I'm saying that this is that, but I'm curious if you ever think that you'll be able to turn this situation into a way that it's been I don't want to say beneficial, but
no, actually, I know what you're saying.
You know what I'm trying to say.
I know exactly what you're saying, and
good. Because a lot of people will probably be like, how the fuck can you say that to somebody?
Exactly, and I've thought this a lot. The idea of transmuting an event like your twin brother's death into something positive is, to most people, offensive and sick. And, you know...
But there are
positives to learn from any situation, no matter how dire. And I think that the real tragedy is letting those lessons go. Because then what's it all been for? What was it worth? You know? Do you know what I mean?
I mean, like, that's the constant question anyway, but yeah, I get
it. It's... You know, it's that thing in life, win or learn. And losing Tom is a massive loss. But what can I learn from it? Yeah. And how can I take it and help it, I don't know, enhance my life in some way and bring about more joy in my life?
I think that the reality, when it hits home, that when somebody gets ill that you love very much, it does make you appreciate what you have. And I think that's more of what I was trying to say. As you said, I didn't mean that to sound...
No, it does.
I was being a shitbag.
The architects, I mean, it's... I appreciate it so much more now.
But it's such a horrendous lesson, isn't it?
Why is it that humans always have to learn in a state of sorrow and tragedy and trauma? It's so often the way.
Yeah. But then again, you could look at that's the coping mechanism. Maybe that's how we draw some solace in amongst misery, is that, well, I think with the band, to use that as an example, I think the reaction that you've had recently, and, you know, it's been a long time coming anyway, man. Like, and you guys would have been the first to have said that several years ago.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the band has worked so hard and has consistently made amazing music. And it's been growing constantly, but it just feels like there's been such an outpouring of love.
And like I said, I've only been able to access that recently.
Yeah.
Because I just didn't care before.
Well, of course.
But now it's like I'm just constantly overwhelmed and surprised and shocked at the reach that the band has now. The level of popularity that it's achieved is just so.
And I don't mean beyond. This to yeah, I don't mean that to say like, oh, you'd have never have got like
no, but
which is anyone that doesn't know us is probably going to listen to this and be like, wow. But I mean in the sense that I will never forget when you were doing the eulogy and you said that so dark, where Tom said, how are the tickets doing?
Yeah. And he said, drop the cancer bomb. It'll sell out in the day or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. You know, and it's funny because we wanted the band to be our career, obviously.
Yeah.
What musician doesn't?
Yeah.
And we scraped by for 5 albums, some of which were really well received and some not so much. And then, of course, Tom got cancer. It's so funny to term it as cancer. It was a mole on his leg.
Hmm.
You know, I'll draw out the story a little bit more.
Yeah.
He had a weird-looking mole on his leg, and it was... obviously weird, I will say that. I mean, in retrospect, you could tell it was bad. But I dropped him off at a dermatologist, and then he called me and said, oh, they're cutting it off right now. And I was like, okay, I'm coming up. Not worried. I was like, this is going to be funny.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to get to watch my twin brother have a mole cut out of his leg under local anaesthetic and he's going to be cringing and squirming and I'm going to film it on my phone and the doctors let me. And if you go through all the way through my Instagram account right near the start, there's a picture of Tom holding up a vial with a mole in it because we thought it was funny.
Yeah.
Because there's no way it was going to be bad. But it was. And obviously it hit us all. And trauma or pain or suffering is so often the catalyst for great art.
Yeah. It's not a necessity, but...
Not a necessity, you're right, because...
There are great works of art that aren't.
People always say tortured artists. You have to be a tortured artist to write great music. And then I always think of Dave Grohl. Okay, obviously went through an enormous tragedy in his life and wrote great records subsequently.
Yeah.
But also, I'm not sure that Kurt Cobain's death was the catalyst behind Foo Fighters' fourth or fifth albums, which were still great.
Yeah.
And he was obviously comes across as an extremely jovial, happy, content and affable man, yeah. Famously so. But we wrote Lost Forever, Lost Together, and you know it was a massive breakthrough for us, and it was such a joyful time because Tom's cancer was like, by the time it came out, it was ancient history already. You know, he did 6 months, every 6 months he went for an appointment and he got checked out, but it was like that is done, you know. And you look at the statistics, you know, some people die of this, but at this stage the odds look pretty good for Tom, so all good. And it was, that just felt like, everything we had ever worked for was coming to fruition.
Yeah.
And it was just, it felt like we sort of had everything. And then, of course, cancer came back, and that was then the catalyst for the second album. And that's led us to where we are now. And you know, I think obviously losing Tom has galvanized fans where they want to get behind us, which is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, Tom, I don't want to say Tom didn't care about the success. All that stuff just sunk to the background. And by the time the album got released, we did two album release shows in Brighton and Tom was really ill, you know.
Yeah.
And we didn't care. Like, I remember telling Tom, oh, the album charted number 8 in the German charts. And he was like, okay, whatever. I don't care. It's like, I'm really ill. I don't give a shit about that. And then obviously we played in there's so much to talk about. So we did those album release shows and Tom was really not well.
Was that because of the treatment more than
the
illness?
We didn't know at the time.
Okay.
But and the jury's still out, actually.
Okay.
We'll never know. But he had back pain because it was affecting his back. And he had back pain earlier in the year when we were on tour with Parkway Drive, and we just thought, oh, hopefully it's nothing. Then we shot music videos with it, and he had to take it easy because it was really bothering him. And he started doing those meditations that we were talking about earlier, and all his pain just went away. For about 2 months. And then he's like, anyone who's been in that situation knows that the symptoms is just like a lottery, just it could be all sorts.
Yeah.
But we went to hospital after those album release shows and they told him it was bad, and they wanted to keep him in. And he said, "No, I'm going on tour tomorrow. Sorry, I don't care."
Yeah.
And so we played Rockham Ring and Rockham Park, and it was crazy. Like, Tom had to have oxygen on the bus, and my girlfriend was on tour just to look after him, and she had bitten off more than she could chew because she, you know, when we had been on tour earlier in the year, we gave Tom specific foods and supplements, and
yeah.
It was a drag. So we said, to my girlfriend Emily, well, you come on tour and do that for him, and we'll pay you. So Tom doesn't have to worry about that stuff. So he can enjoy his time with everyone else like normal, and that stuff is just done for him. But he was far more ill than we had anticipated. And he just like Rockham Ring was the first show, and it just seemed impossible that he would play. Like, I walked into the toilet Dover when we were going over there, you know, and he just meditated all day, pretty much.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Much, probably 4 or 5 hours, and hobbled up and had his guitar put on him, and he walked on stage and he just stood there. But it was just like sheer determination, you know. And there was a massive storm, bunch of people got struck by lightning, and the stage times all got put back, and we played at about midnight, and it was one of the best shows we ever played. And then the last show we ever played was the next day. Last show he ever played was Rockin' Park, and he just seemed so ill. It just seemed like there was no way he was going to do it. And then I had been on the bus with him. I walked back to the dressing room and told the guys, like, we're going to have to work out a way to do this. It was a four piece. Like, I had been working on trying to sort it out so we could have his guitars on tracks, so we could make the show happen. And then, like, he just, like, walks into the dressing room, like, hey, guys, what's up? Like, seemingly fine. And played the show and was, like, sat after the show. And I remember he was sat hanging with some of the guys from While She Sleeps, like, behind the stage. And they were none the wiser.
Yeah.
You know, and there was, the day before at Rockham Ring, some friends had been after him in other bands that were playing. We just said he had the flu, you know, just... He didn't want the attention or the fuss.
Yeah.
And we did a festival in Holland. We played as a four piece. He couldn't do it. It was too early in the day because he was really bad in the mornings. We were playing around midday, and then we did a show in Hamburg with Killswitch Engage, and he just stayed in a hotel day, and we played as a four piece. And the next day we were playing in Luxembourg, and it was like 40 minutes before we were due on stage. And Tom said to me, "Oh, I need some oxygen." And I said, "Well, you know." The doctor's surgeries are closed, we have to get you an ambulance. He said, come get me an ambulance, whatever. And so they came and they took his vital. They gave him oxygen, but they took his vital and they're like, you've got to go to hospital, like, this is crazy. He would have died if he hadn't gone to hospital. So we took him in and cancelled the tour. That's not true, actually. We didn't cancel the tour. We said, oh, we'll get him treated and then we'll drive to Greenfield tomorrow and we'll play the festival. Tom was like, he got taken into ICU and was having a blood transfusion because he was anemic, and they had him on antibiotics and some steroids. And he was like, so what's going on? What's like going on with the tour? And I was like, well, maybe we'll cancel Greenfield and we'll do Download. And he was like, yeah, okay, yeah. Seems crazy, but yeah, it was all crazy at the time. Like, what a ridiculous situation to be in. And then at 8 a.m, he called me and he was not in a good way, and it got worse. And yeah, they had to put him into a coma. And they said to me, like, they didn't say he's never going to wake up. They said he might never wake up.
Yeah.
And if he does, it could be a month or more. And the oncologist back in the UK told my mum, like, don't let them put him in a coma because he won't wake up.
Wow.
And he was already in a coma at that point. And he was just sort of like, you know, it's so strange just being with someone in a coma because you can't communicate and there's just sort of numbers on a screen. And that's what you're going. That's he can't ask. You can't ask how are you. You just look at the numbers, you know. So I was like, I convinced some of the people that worked there that I was a doctor. No, I didn't purposely like trick them, but I had gotten to the point where I had become so entrenched in cancer and the way the human body worked and reading vital signs on a screen that I just knew what I was talking about by that point.
Yeah.
And he was like the same for a few days, and then the fourth day he looked like his blood oxygen was a lot better, and they had sped because he was having a breathing tube. They had they had changed his breathing to a more normal rate, so slowed it down. And his hemoglobin was getting better, and then like I had just imagined Tom waking up over and over for those 5 days, and they said they would let us know if they're going to wake him up. We just turned up one morning, walked in, and he was just like looking at us. It's like, hi. He was confused as fuck because he had been in a coma for 5 days, but he was just like,
but
he was just awake. And then a week later we cancelled the air ambulance that they wanted him to get, and me and Tom got the train home. And that is a serious roller coaster to go through.
Yeah.
And
So when he was in, so it was a medically induced coma.
Yes.
What did they say to him? How was that approached? You must have spoken with him about it.
Yeah, like about what? Why they were doing that.
No, and what?
What happened? Or
yeah, I just
it was inflammation in his lungs.
Yes,
essentially.
Okay, but so I just find the whole thing is so mind blowing, because I've only ever dealt with it in such a kind of a distant fashion.
I mean, it was such a. I sort of lived all of it with Tom, you know.
Mm.
And like it was such an obsession of mine to get him better. But it was like, it meant that I couldn't really process anything at the time.
Yeah, because all you're focusing on is
Tom. This is where we need to get to. And oh, this has gotten worse, but here's why, and here's how it's going to be okay.
Hmm.
Was what I always had to do.
Are you glad that you immersed yourself in all that information, or because it's one of those things, isn't it? It's like as soon as people are ill, they're like, the worst thing you can do is look on the internet.
Yeah, and I wanted to protect Tom from it, but so I saw all the bad information as well as good information, but I just thought, I kind of had this attitude that I can achieve anything I want to as long as I put my mind to it.
Yeah.
And the jury's out on that in matters of life or death, especially when it's someone else's life.
Yeah.
And that's no slight on Tom saying he could have done better and saved his own life, because that's not how it works.
No.
He was in an immensely difficult situation, and one that I still can't understand. But yeah, I had an unhealthy obsession with it, for sure.
Yeah. But then I think it's understandable, because that's, you are going to look for everything and try and help in every way you can.
Yeah, I mean, it just felt like the only option, and you know, I probably could have done things slightly differently, but I don't regret anything, and I feel exempt of any kind of guilt of, you know, I could have done more.
Yeah, but
I don't feel like that. I feel like I did everything I could.
No, I agree. And I think that is the most brutal part of it, aside from him being gone, is the fact that the guilt resides, and I don't think there is it's such an unnecessary thing.
Mm.
And I think it would be truly misplaced. But
I've been exempt from guilt, fortunately.
Good,
but it came at a cost. It came at like total immersion in a very difficult experience. But at least I've not had to feel any feelings of guilt over it. So
yeah,
that has been a positive. But yeah, I hope I don't have to revisit any of that information. I wrote like 76 pages on cancer, trying to piece together the puzzle as if anyone else hadn't already done it, you know. Just desperation, I suppose, you know, thinking, well, if I put it all together, maybe I'll see something I missed.
But then I think it's also a way of processing that and dealing with it, and eventually maybe accepting some of the outcomes.
Well, and here's the thing about it, that is, I don't think Tom, as we've said, was, you know, talking about beating it always, even in the hospice. We were talking about the next album in the hospice.
Yeah.
Because his intention was to leave the hospice. He went to the hospice not because he thought he was going to die, but because he had pain and it was easier than the hospital and nicer, and he knew it was an option.
See, that's something I didn't know. Because being quite outside of that entire world, like my mum's had it twice. But it never got to the point where she went into hospice, and I always assumed that that was...
Glad to hear it.
Yeah. I always assumed that that was... You know, when I heard that he'd gone in, I instantly assumed that that meant...
Yeah, no, we talked. We were talking about the next tour.
I find that quite hard to say to you. But
he was saying, "Oh, I might." Well, I don't think Tom was like, "I don't think I'm going to be able to do this Australian tour." And there was a point when he was like, "Oh, and that UK European tour might be difficult."
Yeah,
and he was, and that's when he said, "What?"
The thing that it's even that it was even in discussion is mind blowing, isn't it?
Just stubbornness, I guess. But you know, I only accepted that he might die about 4 days before he died.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, he said at one point, like, "Oh, I don't think I'll be able to do that European tour and the UK tour, but I might be able to come to the Brixton show." Yeah, and he was like, "Yeah, he said that he would like Josh to play for us."
Yeah, I was wondering how you go about finding somebody to do that.
Sure. Well,
because that's...
Before Adam joined, we begged Josh to join.
Okay.
And that's no slight on Adam. It's just that Josh lives in Reading and Adam lives in Vancouver.
It's just geography.
It's just geography.
Yeah.
And Josh had been filling in for us after Tim left. And we loved him. And we've known him for years. Like, we played Ashford Downtown Diner supporting Psilosis in 2006 or 7. You know, we stayed at Josh's parents' house when we recorded Ruin, and his girlfriend's student housing. Like, yeah. We've known Josh for years, and he's always been a good friend, and he's obviously a freak show guitarist.
Oh, unreal.
And yeah, I mean, when Tom said, "I don't think I," you know, he said, "I won't be able to come to the I might be able to come to the Brixton show, but I'll only be able to enjoy it if Josh is playing." So I told Josh that, and he didn't have a fucking choice. You know, like, you tell him, I told him that it's like the biggest emotional blackmail ever. He couldn't say no.
Yeah.
But I know that Josh feels honoured to take that spot, and he's been brilliant, and we knew he would be. It was just one of those things that is just meant to be, and he's done it with so much grace in such a difficult situation, because it's not easy, you know. Like,
no, of course not, because playing guitar aside, the technicality of that is one thing, and that's a big ask anyway.
Yeah,
but I think it's all the other stuff, which can only be done by somebody that knows everybody and knows the situation.
Sure. And Josh, you know, Josh visited Tom in the hospice, and Josh was at Tom's funeral. Like, he's very, like, already close to us, and there's just no one else it could have been. So I've told Josh this, it's just been a blessing that we've been able to have him with us, because I just don't know what on earth we would have done, you know, had we not had him as an option, because I don't know where we would have looked, you know. But
yeah,
it was just seamless and easy with him. And you know, someone might imagine me sort of looking at whoever fills Tom's shoes with some kind of bitterness or something. I don't know, like some kind, there might be something odd about it, or I might feel uneasy about whoever takes that spot. But Josh is just great, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy about that. And I know that was what Tom wanted, so that's also good to know, you know.
Yeah.
Because here's the other thing. Because Tom didn't talk about dying, there was no sort of handover, really, and there was no real, like, if I die, do this. You know, Tom didn't sort of express any architect's life after Tom sort of plan or what he wanted. But
because he didn't even see that was actually
he would a possibility. Occasionally he'd be like, oh, I've been thinking stupid stuff, like, who's going to use my gear if I die? But then,
he's more worried about the gear.
Yeah. But so
yeah,
because Tom wasn't talking about dying and wasn't planning on dying, you know, we talked about the next album loads.
Yeah.
We talked about what it was going to be like, what direction we wanted to go in.
Have you had those conversations since? Because that's obviously...
Sure, we've written songs.
You have?
Yeah. And I...
With Josh?
Yeah.
How's that?
A whole new experience. And, you know, it's...
It must be very tough.
Yes and no. You know, me and Tom finished a couple songs.
Okay.
Ages ago. You know, like, because once Tom really got... Tom was sick for 3 months. He had cancer for 3 years, but he was sick for 3 months. So after we finished All Our Gods, yeah, we wrote a couple songs, and they're great, and people will hear them. And but of course, after Tom died, after the dust settles, there is a bit of like, well, I love doing this, and we all do, and we want it to continue, and Tom would want it to continue.
Yeah, of course.
But then there's the matter of, you know, can we do Tom's legacy justice? And you don't want to just fizzle out and do something rubbish or substandard. You know, it's got to be. Context. It's an unusual situation.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Kurt Cobain didn't die, and Nirvana carry on.
Mm.
Of course, you know, that would be like losing Sam as well, in a sense, because there's still a lot of character that the rest of the band carries. But obviously, Tom's part of the band is—he's at the core of it, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, after Tom died publicly, that, you know, I don't want to pretend that Tom wasn't vital. I don't want to play down his role to make it seem like we have a better shot of carrying on or anything like that, you know, because that's disrespectful.
Yeah.
But I was anxious to know whether we could carry on, because I want to, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's a really good job. I was talking earlier about changing trauma into great art.
Yeah.
I've got trauma in bucket loads.
I was going to say. You've got the opportunity, but without meaning to sound glib, but you've got... It's going to be the most apparent way that you can all, as a group of friends, work through something.
Sure, Yeah, absolutely. And learning guitar, and you know, I've been my role with Tom in terms of writing, really, especially on the last two albums, and really especially on All Our Gods, was Tom would write something, might be a riff or two riffs, and then we would sit down together and think about where it's going to go. Mm. And I would turn it into a song, you know, structure it, tell him what I don't think works, and tell him that that bit sounds like a verse, not a chorus, or whatever, you know. Yeah. The sort of producer's role, in a sense, arrangement stuff. It's difficult for me to talk about because I don't want to, like, big myself up. Like, oh, actually, I'm more important to architects than everyone thinks.
I don't think anyone's going to sit there and think that that's what you're doing, and I don't think anyone would probably undersell your part within the band any more than you would. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
I think that is something that a lot of people are very guilty of, in a sense that a lot of musicians will always downplay what they do. But I don't think anyone's going to go, look at this guy now. All of a sudden,
turns out he was the brains. Yeah, no, and I don't want to pretend that is the case, but I also did play a sizable role in the writing of the songs.
Yeah.
And that role has had to be increased, but that's really helped me, you know. Yeah. Always any kind of creative expression is good in these kind of instances, you know. And again, I just wanted to, like, dive into it, and you know, that's why a week after Tom died, I didn't know what to do, so I went and got that guitar right there and was like, all right, I'm gonna play guitar. I'm not going to be architect's guitarist, but I'm going to learn guitar. I'm going to learn to play guitar, because why not, you know?
Yeah.
And that's not to say that I'm going to write loads of riffs on the next album and they're going to sound like they'd be like the most basic riffs you've ever heard, which unfortunately is not what we do. But it's been a whole new experience for me in terms of being creative and what that does for me, and the sort of I want to say like the more sort of I want to say mystical side of that process.
Yeah,
that's been a massive learning curve for me. And I've never been the sort of the origin of creation before. I've sort of worked with something that's been created.
Hmm.
And so now I've have a chance to be the origin. Not entirely. Other guys are part of it. But that's interesting. And the way things come to you. And when I write something and it sounds like Tom wrote it, that's a really interesting thing for me.
Yeah.
Where I'll write it and then listen back and think, this sounds exactly like Tom would have wrote it. This sounds, you know, Tom always wrote something and sent me, just one riff, send me in my email.
Mm.
You know, and I know that I'm not doing it purposefully. You know, it's just that we were very different people in many ways, but very similar in lots of ways as well, especially our tastes.
Yeah.
We're very similar.
And I think, yeah, this is an interesting thing. This is a whole other world to talk about, because for a start, I played in a band which had twins in it for a long time, and I
oh of course yeah
yeah sorry
no that's
but
right.
I would
the Perrys
yeah so I would see
is that a drummer and singer
yeah. But I would still see the connection between the two, maybe not in a musical sense, but I would see how they both were.
Mm.
You know, stupid stuff like getting up in the morning and wearing the same clothes. Right, which sounds like a ludicrous, like, twin, like, cliche.
Yeah, me and Tom avoided that.
Yeah, good. But
But what I'm saying is, I would see that connection. Yeah. There would be certain things, like one of them would say something to me if we were in rehearsal, and then would leave the room, and then the other one would turn up and say the exact same thing, word for word.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's something I think is really interesting.
It is.
And also, I think maybe this is a conversation. Like, there's certain things that I'm curious, that I just want to ask you, but I don't know that it's now. This is the situation.
Well, that's your call.
Yeah,
I'm open. You know.
I know, but I think it's interesting. One of the things that made me laugh at the that sounds like a terrible thing to start a sentence with. One of the things that made me laugh at the wake was when you were saying about shopping for a crack pipe to smoke DMT.
Yeah. It's up there.
What, the pipe?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was you know, hilarious the way you said it, and you said sorry to one of your aunts, I think.
Yeah.
But it made me think about that and how DMT is viewed by can be viewed by people as being a almost like a way to enter into other states of mind or other realms of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Which throws open a whole interesting conversation about that, because I know that was something that all of you guys in the band are into or interested in, right?
Everyone except Sam, yeah.
Except Sam?
Yeah.
Ah, interesting.
Sam's not a hallucinogenic fan. He has done them. We've peer pressured him into mushrooms on Warped Tour.
Peer pressure. Okay.
Oh, that's a whole different story.
Because I had a conversation with him about that, about DMT. And he was saying that they'd been, I don't know, he said to me that there'd been talk about smoking some at a particular time and in a particular place.
Yeah, haven't done it.
Good. Because I don't think that's the ideal set and setting.
To venture. Disclaimer: I haven't smoked it.
Yeah.
At all, I haven't smoked any yet. You know, and it's. I don't have any. I've got a substitute, but I've just been. That's something I want to do, and I want it to be the like time. I've been in a strange place, you know.
No shit.
And I've had friends who are experienced with those kind of things say maybe just wait a moment.
Yeah, that's what I think as well. Not that I'm experiencing.
Tom said. Tom bought it as a gift for me from him. Ultimately now, but he said to me, me and him got picked up in an ambulance in Luxembourg from the bus to get to the hospital, and we were riding in the back of the ambulance, sirens and everything. And Tom said to me, when he woke up from the coma, he said to me, all I was thinking about in the ambulance was, fuck, I never got around to smoking that DMT. But yeah, that is something that fascinates me. And me and Tom love doing magic mushrooms together. We did them lots of times together. It shaped to who we are in many ways, you know.
Yeah.
It does change it, you know.
Oh, 100%.
In a good way.
Yeah. I think things which may be ways of altering consciousness or accessing other states of consciousness and places that are spoken of in a mystical manner probably, is best waited on a little while, but also I'm optimistic.
I understand.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. And I am too.
Yeah. I think it's such a weird one, and it's almost like I don't want to be like, I can't even say it. Are you an optimistic person now? With regard to, well, as you said earlier, you know, the physicality of who we are isn't, you know, there's a little more going on than that. Or we'd like to think, right?
Yeah, I think it's highly likely in my view.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How so? Just through optimism or through meditation and whatnot? Or, I don't know, it's not even a question.
I said earlier, I sort of feel like I can achieve anything I put my mind to. And I still believe that, even though I thought that would work with Tom. I think that's a different case. I feel very...
I feel like we're skirting around things.
Yeah, we should probably
turn this off and have a conversation.
But yeah, I feel... Let's put it to more basic terms. I feel very good about the future. I feel inspired, and I feel strongly that I want to do Tom's Legacy proud, and that means a lot to me. I feel good about who I am. And here's something that's odd as well. I feel more like Tom than I ever have done before in my life.
That's interesting.
And I had felt that sensation, that feeling. I would say things sometimes, or think things, or feel things, where I think that's what Tom was like, you know. And then following that, I had two or three people in quick succession tell me there's more of Tom in you now than there ever was before, and it's a beautiful thing. But you could have all sorts of thoughts on that, why that is.
Yeah.
But I feel it's very, very noticeable, and the more I notice it, the more it comes through. Tricking myself, you know.
Being devil's advocate. I'm all for.
Who knows?
Let's head towards the mystical.
Sure. Yeah, and I suppose it doesn't matter either way. But yeah, I feel really. Yeah, it's a strange phenomena, and I can't explain it. And I have all, I've listened to your podcast, Dan, and I know that I can hear the apprehension in your voice sometimes when you start edging into mystical subjects.
Well, like, that's my thing. That's my whole agenda, is like, how am I going to shoehorn this in?
Does this person
think I'm crazy?
yeah, sure. And I'm pretty sure we share common ground. I know we do, because we've spoken before about this kind of thing. And then it comes to the point where you're doing something like this, and you think,
I don't know.
But it's more than just the two people here that are going to think.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think about Tom very intently when I'm meditating. And it physically has a bizarre physical effect on me. Like, if I get deep enough, all the hairs on my body stand on end.
What do you think that means?
I find it comforting. I'll say that.
Perfect.
But yeah, who really knows? But I think about Tom when we're writing, you know. When we're writing music, what would Tom do? What would Tom think? Would Tom think that this is shit? You know?
Yeah.
Tom could be self-deprecating.
Yeah.
And I found actually that Tom became the less self-deprecating Tom was, the better the music got, actually.
Yeah.
And there's a balance, isn't it? You don't want to be overconfident and cocky and think you're the best. But
Shouldn't you also
don't want to put yourself down.
You don't want to start believing it.
Because Tom said that Match Made in Heaven deserved to win a Grammy. And, you know, I think he thought, you know, well, if I die, then I'll probably get a Grammy. But I've I'm excited that we're that there will be more music. I don't know when. I don't know when we're going to release anything.
Do you know what you're going to, in what format you do it? Would it be not straight in with an album?
I don't know yet. I really don't know yet, and I don't want to. I don't really want to speculate too much, but I just.
It's better just to let those things happen and see where you end up.
Exactly, and it's going to be. It's hard not to. I try not to think about what people will think. You know, David Bowie says, "Don't play to the gallery. Don't worry about your audience."
Yeah.
And when I'm writing, I don't. When I'm not writing, when I'm walking down the street, sometimes I think, "What are people going to make of it?" You know, because, like I said, I spoke with Tom all the time about the next album. I know exactly what we want. We know what we want to do.
Yeah.
I know what Tom wanted to do, and I intend to honour that and respect that.
Is it going to sound like Tool?
Shh. But I don't want to think too much about it, because, you know, if we release something radically different hypothetically, then people might think, oh well, that's because Tom didn't write it. If we write something exactly the same, well, I don't want
to go, oh, they're trying to sound, yeah.
We're trying to rip off Tom's riffs, or
you can't.
You can't win.
No,
you can't win.
It is actually, yeah.
So we'll just do what we do, and you know, it's so important to me that the quality is there, and so however much time that takes, it doesn't matter. You know, yeah. I don't think.
Do you think you're going to be even more critical, though, when you're writing? I think you will, personally.
Yeah, and do you know what? Like, Tom was...
And it wasn't like you weren't before.
No, and Tom was brutal. I would say he was too hard on himself. And set standards that were unattainable for himself. And that made him unhappy sometimes, because, of course, it did.
Yeah.
I am, you know, like Tom put Sam through them. There you go.
I can imagine.
Goodness. Like, I don't think Sam would mind me saying, like, Sam worked so hard on All Our Gods that at one point Sam just broke down in tears. Because he was just emotionally fraught, you know, and screaming like that for hours on end, day after day, you know, it's just not normal. But, you know, more often than not, you know, it was Tom saying, and again, not necessarily, you know, the guys that we recorded the last two records with could be tough, but Tom was the real, he was the one holding the whip, really. And, well, now, well, maybe I have to do that. I don't know. We'll, you know, I think it's important for all of us to push each other, but it was easy for me to stand and let Tom...
Do the pushing,
yeah, sometimes. But I know that all the guys, of course, I'm not, that makes it sound like the other guys are sort of have low standards, which is not the case.
No, of course not. But you need someone. You do need someone to play that role, and it is a tough role to play, because you have to know when it's right to push and when you're just being a dick.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's, you know, that is a fine balance to walk.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I find it interesting that you're saying that people are commenting about how they see so much of him in you now. That then maybe that will be the means for that to happen.
Perhaps.
You will be that whip hand.
Yeah, perhaps I will. And I just hope that everyone else in my band understands. but everyone, you know, like, everyone is, it's not all just about me, you know, like, no, we're talking not a lot from my point
that's
of view.
That's because you and I sat here talking.
Yeah, but, you know, the other guys, it's harsh. It's a very, very heavy situation for everyone, and, you know, they were all deeply entrenched in everything that unfolded.
I don't think anyone's going to judge you and be like,
it's all about Dan, isn't it? Yeah. I know. Going on tour after it happened was just, for Sam, I just felt Sam having to speak about it publicly night after night.
Yeah. And sing those words.
And there have been a few nights like it in London, and I spoke actually when we were in Russia as well. Before we played Gone with the Wind, just I felt like it was necessary on those occasions, and it's really not easy. And I commend Sam for having gotten through all those nights doing that, because it's hard. And the strangest thing is for me playing live is that everyone probably thinks that I sit there the whole set feeling sad, thinking I wish Tom was here and why not, that Tom's not stood there, but it mostly doesn't occur to me.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I just play, and I don't think about him being absent. It's only when Sam mentions about Tom right at the end of the set that I go, fuck, yeah. It hits me.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always hit me. Some nights I'm just like, okay, you know, let's play the song, you know. And then some nights it's like hits me right in the chest, you know. It's a strange thing, but it's a public, it's very public grieving, you know, going on tour like that, and people knowing what you've been through, as you know, everyone. I felt like people gravitate towards me a little bit, which I understand.
That must be overwhelming, because they must want to.
Sure, I don't want to talk about it all the time.
Yeah, of course. And I think the thing is, once somebody is so in love with a band that they invest all their emotions in it, because it speaks to them, they're going to want to come up to you and project that at you.
Yeah, and I can't deal with it.
I can't imagine.
And, you know, I've had people come up to me in tears, of course, you know, sometimes maybe I seem cold, I don't know, but I just, you know, I can't. Sometimes I've just gotten out of the dressing room having a beer with my mates, having a laugh, you know, and then to walk straight out just like to the bus and someone's talked to me and they're really upset, I can't always sort of engage in that, because it's I can't constantly turn that on and off. And sometimes once I've turned it off, I've turned it off quite pretty hard to make sure I don't have to deal with that for the rest of the day, because I can't carry it with me all the time.
Of course not. And I think most people are going to be able to understand that, not everyone, because people get lost in themselves, don't they, when they're fans at gigs can be a little have like the blinkers on, and they're just, I need to do this, or they want to meet this person, even if it's just to get something signed, I've got to meet them, you know. It's like an imperative that it happens. So I can only imagine how that would then be in a situation you're in. So it's a tough one. And I think the flip side of that is it brings us back round to why I'm sat here talking to you now, in the same sense, to a certain degree, that everyone is going to want to talk to you about it.
There are things that, you know, I've spoken about that I think it was important for people to know. You know, for some reason it felt important for me for people not to paint this super bleak image of everything that happened. Because it was really fucking hard, and it was horrible, a lot of it, but we had great times amongst it, and Tom was great. We were sat smoking weed, blasting Kolos by Meshuggah in the hospice with the doors open, you know, like it, having fun,
yeah,
which just sounds absurd under the circumstances.
I don't think so. I think it's beautiful.
But it was just like, well, what else are we going to do? And that's what Tom wanted to do, you know. I think that's important to me, that people know, I guess, how well Tom dealt with it, but you know, also that there can be beautiful moments amongst really challenging times, you know. And I hope that we can continue that trend, you know, even now when things are so still difficult. You know, you've seen while I've been talking to you, it's not easy for me to speak about a lot of it. And it's not the kind of thing you ever get over, I suppose, but the emotions aren't that dulled. It's only been 6 months, but I still feel strongly that we can create something amazing out of this situation and carry the band forward.
I think you already have, though.
Yeah. And
I think that those next steps, which you would almost say are the logical steps, but they're not really, because it's not a sort of straightforward logical situation, but the next steps I'm really looking forward to.
And I am too. And it's unique. And when something like this happens, you look for comparisons. Humans love to do it, don't they? Try and relate to someone, to something.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I look at Vinnie Paul losing his brother.
Yeah.
And then I think about, like, Suicide Silence, losing Mitch. Plenty of bands have lost people.
But they're not you.
But it's not me. And it's so unique that... we lost Tom and were able to even go and play one show in a way, you know, and then to carry on beyond that, you know, losing the main songwriter of the band. It's a risk, but it's just an unusual and rare situation, and I feel as though my presence in the band almost gives it the go ahead in a sense.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because you wouldn't want to just be carrying the carcass of a band that's done to make some money or whatever it is, you know. Yeah. But I'm able to authentically say that we can carry on. We should carry on. I know we should carry on. I know Tom wants us to carry on. I know we can. And again, comes back to my belief in belief. You know, I believe very strongly that we'll carry on. I believe very strongly that we will continue to make good music and carry the band forward. And that is, I'm trying not to obsess over that.
I think you will.
Yeah, it's important to me because I know it's a representation of Tom. And you know, no matter what we do, there's Tom in there. I mean, quite literally, two of the songs, you know, were Tom wrote, but Tom will always written be a part of it.
Were those written and finished?
Yeah. Yeah. And there were a few other things that we had worked on that were unfinished.
Are you going to carry on with those, do you think?
Yeah, I finished one of them, yeah. We started writing a third song, and I messed around with it for ages because it felt so important that it had to be right. Yeah. Because it was like literally taking the bones of a song and completing it like I would have done with Tom, but it was one of those ones, you know, I don't have Tom's approval. So I just, it really strained over it, but I'm very, very happy with it. But it's a long way before, sadly, most people will hear it. But I'm excited that there will be a chance at some point for people to hear that stuff. And I'm excited that Tom is a part of it, and Josh is a part of it, and all the guys are a part of it now, you know. So, and I think there will be more collaboration between the whole band as well, which is a nice thing for everyone, I think.
Yeah, because I think it'll be an amazing way for everyone to come pull even closer and
it will resonate forward. Will resonate with, you know, you don't have to be a genius to work out what the album will be about, you know.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to episode number 18 of Someone Who Isn't Me with Dan from Architects. That was a very different episode, and yet I really enjoyed hanging out with him, regardless of what the conversation was about. which was really heavy. And I know that sounds kind of a weird thing to say, but he's an amazing person and a good dude. So, yeah. So he can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Dan Architects. I'm at Daniel P. Carter. If you go to iTunes, you could leave a nice 5-star rating and a review or comment or something. That would be wicked. Also, as I said at the start, I know that a lot of this is probably going to get used on some news sites or in print perhaps, which is fine because that's essentially why Dan contacted me in the first place to do this. So yeah, please try and keep things in context. Also, please don't turn any of this into clickbait because it just feels really cheap. Thanks for listening. I'm out. Peace.